Coffin, Spalding, Walls, by Dixie Hibbs for the Kentucky Oral History Commission, the Prohibition and its Effects on Nelson County. Interview was conducted in Bardstown, Kentucky, Nelson County, on Templin Avenue on September 26, 1988. Liv, would you like to tell me something about yourself?
Well, I was born in Bardstown, July 6, 1916. I've lived here all my life. My parents are deceased. They were Alfred Smith Watson and Teresa Cecil Watson. My mother was a native of LaRue County. My father was born in Nelson County and spent his entire life here. As a young man, he became an apprentice printer and at the Kentucky Standard, published by the Standard Publishing Company, which is an organization formed in about 1900. As time went on, he came into the ownership, and by mid-1920s was the sole owner of the business.
Then he was, he did operate the local newspaper then during the Prohibition period.
Yes, he operated, he was the publisher of the Kentucky Standard during the Prohibition era.
Do you remember the first time that you heard any reference to the term Prohibition, or when did you realize that Prohibition was a situation going on in Nelson County? Or, I know if you were born in 16, you weren't very old in 1920, but it would go on for 13 years, so.
Well, see, in 1920, I wouldn't have been but 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my teens when I remember that, I remember that making home brew was sort of a pastime for many people, and persons didn't think anything about discussing it, and of course that was an illegal operation, and it was some type of alcohol that they were producing in homes for their own consumption. Now, I assume there were people who sold it, but in my own home, my dad liked to have bottle of beer and so forth, and so they manufactured, had this big, I think it was maybe a 10 or 20 gallon crock,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember anything about anybody cooking anything, but my mother must have brewed it up on an old coal range which we had in the kitchen, on those cast iron ranges.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a child, my dad in the evening, when it was time to bottle it, he had his own capper, and I imagine many other people did too. They would bottle it, and I don't know, I guess it had to age some. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't age much in bottles, though, would it?
Sure enough, but again, the carbonation, maybe you had to put it in the bottle to keep the carbonation from, or the gas aspect of it,
And I'll go back and tell a little bit more about myself. I told you I lived here all my life, mm-hmm. and graduated from Bethlehem Academy, as it was called at that time, 2 years to Nazareth Junior College. And I planned to teach, and qualified to do that, but wasn't able to get a job the first year, so that I was out of school. So then in the middle of the winter, Wallace Brown, who had been county judge and who had actually was the first editor of Kentucky Standard back in 1900, was elected to the legislature, and we were only printing Standard, it was only about 12 pages a week, very small publication. So my dad asked me, he said, we're going to find someone to do some of Judge Brown's work while he's gone to the legislature. Would you like to try it? Well, it so happened that my best subject in school was English, and I'd always liked to write, so I just started working there, and I liked it very much. And so then the next year, I was offered a teaching job over at Bloomfield by a man named Professor Chilton, but I decided I wouldn't take it. That I liked what I was doing, and I would just continue there. So after two or three years, I decided if I was going to stay in newspaper work, I needed to get more education in that field. So I started going to the University of Louisville at night, and then went to night school quite some time. And then later, Nazareth Junior College became a four-year college. So I lacked just a little bit of having enough credits for a college degree and the sisters' cooperation. I went back and went to school on the Saturdays and took one four-hour course in science through the week and got a college degree. I had done a lot of work in music, and so I my degree is in English and music. And I've always been a person that likes to study. And I kept saying I was going to continue to take more courses, but actually I've always did some things, but I never did do anything else for credit, for college credit. But I found out that I've been associated recently with a young man who tells me he wants to prove his writing, I assume, for a job he has, and I'm going to ask him when I see him if he ever thought about just going to U of L and taking some writing courses right here at our doorstep, and or maybe over Risen Town Community College. But that's not anything to do with this. But one thing I did want to tell you that was always interesting to me, one of my father's good friends was a man named John Marshall. He was vice president of the Louisville Paper Company, and we bought paper from them, and was not only a business friend, but a social friend. And he would call out here, as I remember maybe just going in the standard office as a kid, maybe to get a nickel or a dime from my dad. You'd be getting a call from this John Marshall saying, "Watson, can you get me 2 dozen eggs?" And that was his symbol for
his code.
His code for meaning a certain quantity of moonshine.
2 dozen eggs, I like that.
Or however how many dozen it was, they had their code. When he got it, but my dad would let him know, or whenever he had it ready, then he'd come get it. But that was the, now that and making homebrew were really in our home for just home consumption were really the only two things I ever really heard my father say anything about, you know. But however, he did used to talk about saloons that we had and how many families, a number of families that, whose livelihood came from working and operating and owning saloons, they had moved away. One family was named Conley. And they stayed close to those people. They came back and visited, and my mother and dad visited them in Louisville, but it took them away. It took numbers of families away from here, because when saloons closed, they didn't have, there was no occupation.
Same and way with the distilleries, you think, too? You think some of the distilleries?
Oh, I'm sure so. Mr. Joe Beam, who was a master distiller, made whiskey in Canada for a while. He just left his family here, went up there and lived, came home maybe every 6 months or so, maybe, and made whiskey up there. In other words, there were numbers of people whose livelihood was just gone. And Bardstown was about 1,500 people, I think. And they used to, I had this little saying, said something referred to about Bardstown being dead so long. Well, the reason so dead is that when the series went out, it just changed the whole character of the place.
There wasn't a lot of traffic in and out. Of course, the
illegal part was going on. And there were certain people who were pocketing a lot of money. There were one or two persons that we told about. I don't know whether one of them was Leon Kennedy, who I think made periodic trips to Lowell, supposedly going to U of L. I think he was supposed to be going to U of L. Yeah. He was taking a load of whiskey in every time he went. There are various people, but I mean, many of them are very secretive about their money, and I don't blame them. Well, but as far as it's helping the local economy generally, see, Prohibition didn't. I mean, it was too, it'd be too undercover.
Well, then, do you feel like the atmosphere of acceptance of the illegal whiskey transference, you know, do you think people criticized these people who were running whiskey, or they just ignored them, or? Did you get a feeling about?
Well, I really wasn't old enough to get it, learn much of that.
Well,
I don't think people felt anything about it, really, though, from what I've heard, what I remember hearing my dad talk about. People didn't look down on those people. They just, it's just one of those things they had to put up with.
It's one of the ways they survived.
Yes, and they were.
Well, did they take, you think then that money that they would have made, they had to, they were either buying something or, like you said, maybe they hid their money, but still they. If they bought clothes or automobiles or food and things, that would have helped the economy some.
Well, I guess it did, and I imagine there's a tremendous amount of money flowing in cash. I expect there are plenty of people who didn't.
So the banks really didn't.
Yeah,
didn't
but there's plenty of money that didn't get into banks. People would be fearful they show up in their bank accounts, and it would be disclosed to some illegal operation going on.
Do you think, well, of course you say you don't know whether how much investigating people did or the revenue people did trying to find out who was who had sums of money and who didn't.
I just don't know, they call them revenuers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm sure you've got that story on there about that warehouse, I mean, that the old bar sanitary that was sold and had the warehouses, these people sneaked, you've heard that, haven't you? Sneaked out that whiskey and filled those barrels.
Filled them with water?
With water. And then they something set the place on fire, didn't burn, goes one any whiskey there.
Yeah. And the water kept putting the fire out, right?
Yeah. I can remember one time too, it seems that down at what we call Barton now, it's the old time monastery. I don't remember how what caused the whiskey to be on the river, but it was. It would set fire and you just see those flames, you know.
On the river.
Uh-huh.
You think that they, that when the barrels broke, they ran down a stream or a drain?
Probably
to
so.
The river?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the stories we were hearing was Muir was talking about all of the uproar. They could see that the distillery was on fire, and they ran down there, and he said one of the first things was this call, watch out for the cows, and he said all the cattle were stampeding up the road, and because the fear of the fire, and they were all the cattle down there that had been in the holding pens, you know, to be fed with slop, and that was something you just didn't get in your mind, that we were going to have a cattle stampede in what we now call middle of Bardstown, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
That right.
That. Most of the transfer of liquor then actually was out of the county toward Louisville or just in any direction?
No, I think it was mostly toward Louisville.
Toward Louisville.
And possibly moved on from there, maybe to Chicago or some of these other places. That's guess I'm part of
that
part.
Yeah, I know you. I know that you have connections in the southern part of the county through your mother's
mm-hmm.
family, and that part of the county has always been very independent, the families and all. And we still talk about moonshining and so forth down there. Did you ever get a feeling about that attitude of independence or anything like that come through any of your family conversations or?
No. I tell you, the person I was talking to you about a while ago was Jesse Stiles. He's a big operator in Hattistown, and I think controls little everything, voting and just about everything. And I'm sure, I feel reasonably certain that he was a big operator.
Over there.
In the illegal liquor.
The contact.
I think he possibly was.
Uh-huh, the contact. I understand, of course, I wasn't here. But they had warning that prohibition was going to go into effect. It looks like to me, if I were a distiller, I'd been out there selling everything I could sell as quickly as I could, you know, to people. If you had that 2 years or at least a year before it went into effect, wouldn't you have been selling all your stock as much as you could to try to get rid of it?
Well, it looks like it.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't appear. The whiskey records we have don't show that they are bringing those stocks down very quickly. I mean, it didn't look like they were shipping out a lot, so I don't know whether that.
You know, I don't know. You reckon, did they use the dairy slop to feed cattle?
Yes, they did.
Back there, as we knew it later on, when
they used it,
they
were using it to feed their own cattle operation. They weren't selling it as much to the public as they were having the farms that always surrounded the distilleries,
mm-hmm.
they would have feeder cattle. And even back in the 1820s, which I was very surprised, not locally, but in Louisville, they had the cattle pens and the hog pens. They fed both hogs and cattle, I think. Because it was very high in protein and a very good feed.
This little book I was telling you about is called Archie.
Okay.
And it's a little pamphlet type book, and it sold for $5, and this person who wrote it she's a woman, associate mm-hmm. of this person. I don't know if there was ever any romance there,
mm-hmm.
but I'm trying to think what Archie's last name was.
It's not Spaulding, is it?
Archie Spaulding.
Mm-hmm.
I said Jesse Stiles over there. Jesse Spaulding.
Jesse Spaulding.
I correct myself. Jesse Spaulding. Well, Archie was his brother.
Brother.
And mm-hmm. he had all kinds of, if you get hold of that little book, that really, it
tells
just
you
tells you how much of his, how often he tore up a car, his revenues, and he just run a car until the tires just burn up, you know, on it, and then the revenues be right after him. Next thing you know, he'd have a different car.
You think he got those cars out of town? Do you think that helped our economy any?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know, but there were certain people that
the
revenue officers, or the prohibition officers realized, and they knew it too.
Okay.
These people knew it, they right after them, but they tried to escape, and I think most of them
did. They knew all the back roads and where they were.
Yeah.
Considering they didn't have radios and things like that, like we take for granted now, it's amazing how much they got away and, you know, ran around. And
well, see, I think that one thing, it's, the sympathies were anti-government.
Right.
There wasn't anybody, I don't know, you might find a, maybe a few ministers or preachers who abhorred the fact that people were manufacturing their own liquor and drinking it, but for the most part, the sympathies were all anti-government, don't you think they were?
It appears from everything we're finding
you
out
see,
that it was,
you know what I mean?
Irritating that they had to go along with this because nobody agreed with it.
And I don't guess anybody ever told on anybody else.
I don't know.
I wondered, they may have.
Well, I wondered if there was ever any, what they call, turning state's evidence. You know, in other words, if you got caught, would you get a lighter sentence if you turned in somebody else? I've never heard anything on that either. In reading the old newspapers, of course, they talk about people getting stopped and caught and how much whiskey's confiscated and all of this. But it appears there was a lot more of it done than actually appeared in the newspaper. I mean, that somebody would be picked up, maybe taken to court, and maybe get off with a fine or something, but it usually wasn't over a lot of whiskey. It was minimal.
Well, I doubt very seriously, you know, those. I can remember when I worked, going to the courthouse to look at those records. Those records are nothing like they are today.
Mm-hmm.
You go, I mean, it was hard to get that information off those records. They just jotted down the pencil,
right.
Half lead, and it. I imagine plain things never got on those books.
Right.
Don't you?
Yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. The same thing with, I don't know who was mayor then. I should have looked that up before I started this. Was it Cisco? Was he still
Mr.
mayor?
Cisco was mayor 30 years.
30 years. Well, then he would have been mayor then.
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was succeeded, I think, by Bill Sanders, Leslie Sanders.
Okay, that sounds right. We were discussing that earlier, and I couldn't come up with. I knew that he had been mayor a long time.
I think he was the first mayor.
Mm-hmm.
See, before that, they were governed by Board of Trustees.
He's right. He was
Isn't
mayor.
Isn't that right?
Yes,
and then
96
may have been chairman of the Board of Trustees.
1896 or something.
Isn't that right? Where they may have been chairman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The presiding
the board,
officer.
Right. Uh-huh.
But actually, the mayor system, I mean, I think Mr. John W. Cisco was first mayor.
Well, then, of course, he had nothing to do with the whiskey business, but it, I'm sure, had a lot of effect on his community. But, you know, the other, do you think there's any idea about, with the Stephen Foster, Mauldin County home here, you know, 1922 we purchased, it opened up to the public in 23, this 23 to 33, that 10 years, we did have tourism was really starting here, and people were stopping on their way south and north, and the idea that you did have this traffic through here, you had, you could, of course people could get drinks if they needed to or wanted to, do you think that tourist traffic helped save us, so to speak, considering we weren't able to...
Well, it may must have.
Uh-huh.
But you see, the Old Top Tavern, of course, it used to say, well, various names, you know, it was called, my father said he remembered it as the Newman House.
Newman House, right. Mm-hmm.
But see, it was a stagecoach stop way back.
Mm-hmm. 35.
Uh-huh, and it always hosted visitors.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in other words, our tourism sort of picked up from that, I'd say,
right.
Wouldn't you?
I think that the focus of Mauldin Kentucky Home really started the move.
But
St. Joseph Cathedral had been bringing people.
Yes.
And yes, we always had travelers. I usually say on our earliest travel writer was 1788. The person who came through here and wrote about his trip, the earliest trip account I have is a 1788 trip.
Who wrote that?
Oh, you would ask me.
Sorry.
He was a noble, he was a Frenchman who came through, and I can't remember.
Oh, yes.
But it wasn't Louis Philippe.
Part of Louis Philippe's entourage?
It was before that. But Louis Philippe came in 97. But this one, it's somebody's travels, and I can't remember right now. But he does talk about what he found, and he even mentions the whiskey in this, that the Kentucky corn whiskey, the corn spirits or something like that. It refers to that. But we were... a spot that many people stopped. I think the distance of travel between us and Louisville or Lexington or the next little town made a big difference.
Our lawyers here too.
Right.
This is quite an early town. And you know that old story about Elizabethtown lawyer found out that over here they made more and John...
Ben Harden.
Ben Harden came over and moved over here.
That's right.
So it's one thing, this community has always had some recognition, I guess you'd say, as a cultural place.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of good schools. See, we had Nazareth, and we had Nazareth Academy, of course, and we had St. Joseph College. We were not too far from St. Catherine College,
right.
And there was a Loretta Academy. And then our public school system, see, started in 1910, and it, we've always had good schools. Well, we had, I forgot, the Baptist Institute.
Right, and the Male and Female Academy.
Yes, the Male and Female Academy. I mean, we had...
We had Protestant
and Catholic schools.
Private schools. Mm-hmm.
And I guess the persons who were in here earlier must have been persons of means, or have come from fairly good educational backgrounds themselves, or we never would have had
this. Don't
you feel that
right,
way?
Right, there had to be a
they had to have some
desire
incentive
for,
or desire,
the desire
for education.
And I think that if we want to sit down and analyze, there are a lot of pluses we have here that the people do come and stay. We're really not a place a lot of people come and stay a short time and leave. It seems like that if you sit down and talk to groups of people that, you know, I retired here, but I found a place I liked and we stayed somewhere or other.
I think we're finding a good bit of that today.
Yeah, I think so too.
Mm-hmm. Persons retiring, and particularly Mr. Hussey, some of these people, they like it here and they just stay.
Right.
And of course, not too long after Owen, Illinois came in here, for some reason I was out there with some visitors, and one of the administrators or executives out there just said, well, you people don't realize it, you've got the best of the two worlds here. Said you're within just a day's, or well, an hour's drive of Lexington and Louisville,
mm-hmm.
where you have plenty of opportunities
right.
for educational, cultural advantages and this type of thing, and yet you have a small town atmosphere.
Yeah. We have the medical and cultural advantages of the bigger communities
mm-hmm.
close by, and yet we have the friendliness and the smallness of a small town
right.
that we don't have to deal with a lot of the pollution and a lot of the
crime. That's right, and we don't have the metropolitan atmosphere.
Right, right. You walk down the street. Let me go back a little to Prohibition. We mentioned lawyers a little bit, but did you ever know any of the lawyers of the time that were kind of the ones you called? If you were a rum runner and you got caught or did you, you know, who did you call to come to court? Went to the federal court in Louisville.
I don't know anything about that.
Those. Mm-hmm. Didn't know if you knew anybody that made most of their money on that. I do know there were lots of fines, and I know some people went to prison. There's no question they went to penitentiary for moonshining mostly. Some of it was rum running, but most of it was actually making whiskey.
Making whiskey.
There were different degrees of fines and penalties for the different things. There was some conversation I picked up at one time over someone going to prison, taking the fall, so to speak, for someone else. And while the first man, well, the second man was in prison, the first man supported the man's wife and children and paid the tuition to go to school and all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody has, knows, I hear the story, but I don't hear anybody else that's heard that same thing, so
mm-hmm.
I don't know how much truth is in that. Of course, when Prohibition was over in 1933, we were just beginning, we were in the Depression years. So what would have happened here if Prohibition hadn't come to a halt? I mean, the distilleries that started up surely helped our Depression economy.
Yes.
But
I think many businesses would have gone under. My father said that if it hadn't been just a little bit longer, the Standard Publishing Company, you know, Kentucky Standard would have folded.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it just, there wasn't any business here to support anything.
No advertising and no printing. And
no, well, mm-hmm. and then I'm sure the retail stores and so forth were minimal.
Mm-hmm.
See, there just wasn't any, I mean, the population was down to, practically nothing for the fact that these people weren't any way to earn a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard him say back after I started working, there in 1936, that we owed the local paper company quite a sum. And I remember for two or three years after I was working, we were paying them a little bit of time each month.
Mm-hmm.
People knew that your heart was there, that you know you weren't expecting to, you didn't want to beat them, but you absolutely just did not have it.
Right.
And my father said many times, if it hadn't been that Prohibition was repealed when it was, why? He not only would have lost our business, but many other people would have lost theirs. It's just about to break the country. And that's
mm-hmm.
one reason I think FDR realized that.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't that one of the first things that happened after he became president, wasn't it,
mm-hmm.
to repeal Prohibition?
December 33.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They call it the Great Experiment. in...
You mean the Prohibition era?
Yes, that's what they refer to as the Great Experiment, the fact that they restricted your alcoholic beverage manufacturing consumption, but it didn't work. And it didn't work in the sense that people didn't quit drinking. They just bought it from people who had not paid government tax on it.
Yeah, that's right. All they did is someone said he'd actually, well, Father Willard, who was our pastor here at St. Joseph for 25 years or more, used to say what he did is put whiskey in and put alcohol into the home, mm. where it had not, it was a social
yeah.
change. That before that, if a man was in town, say he farmed and he came in town and he wanted a drink, he went to the saloon and bought a drink, and maybe that was the end of it.
One or two.
And that was the end mm-hmm. of it. Where it changed the whole, it was a real social revolution because it put liquor into the home. And I think there was a borderline of cocktail parties and all that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't used to have liquor served like we have it today.
Mm-hmm. So that it not only didn't work, it almost backfired in that it
That's
really
right.
perpetuated or expanded the drinking instead of
That's that, right.
that way.
It just changed the whole atmosphere. A way people used it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, some of the drugstores, I think, had a license to sell whiskey mm-hmm. or alcohol for medicinal purposes, mm-hmm. and I imagine if you could get on that list, what you're doing all right. I tell you another thing that I remember, we had this old colored fella, black man, who worked at the Standard for 50 years, named Sip Wilson. And I remember he would get on these drinking sprees, wouldn't show up for 4 or 5 days, and I remember my dad referred to him frequently as being on the inebriate list. And the court had this list of these persons who, I guess, they're it's the forerunner of what we would call today an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Guy who's just going to be drinking all the time, and he gets on this inebriate list. Now, what kind of preference he got in court, I don't know. Did anybody else tell you
well,
about that?
Well, it seems
inebriate
like
list?
I saw reference to it on the police court, the city police court records. There's a list about public inebriation, and I think the idea that if you were found to be drinking quite often and they put mm-hmm. you on the list, then if they found you out, they pretty much just took you home or brought you on in, didn't wait to see if you were going to straighten up, because you probably wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you were recognized as having this weakness, maybe that's the way to put it.
And my father also told me this interesting little thing, that about this Sip Wilson was in court. And he was questioned rather strongly about where he was getting his whiskey. And he wasn't going to
tell him.
So he says, a heap sees, but a few knows.
Heap sees and few
knows. But a few knows.
Few knows. Okay. All right.
He wasn't going about to let that out.
Let
his source of supply.
Right, it may dry up.
That's right.
Well, now that's another interesting point. The money, it couldn't be any cheaper than it would have been in the saloon. It looks like it would, I mean, illicit whiskey should have been more expensive than it would have been if you'd bought it right straight from the liquor store. I don't know either. It seems like, though, if you were taking all those chances and paying off the bribes and things that were probably there to try to, you know, move your whiskey around and things, that your product would have cost more.
Well, of course, the legal tax today, you know, being 10.50 or more a gallon, I mean, mm-hmm. that's, the whiskey itself doesn't cost anything
no.
very much.
Mm-hmm.
It's these taxes that you're paying. And I don't know, and as you said, there was a certain amount of expense of operation because they mm-hmm. pay off.
Mm-hmm. But we were talking a little earlier about the sugar moonshine versus the grain moonshine, that they would make whiskey. The moonshiners would buy cornmeal to actually make whiskey, very similar to what you'd be doing it legally, using the grains and fermenting them in yeast and fermenting them and then putting them, you know, distilling it and mm-hmm. putting it in a container. And then later on they got to using the sugar all the time because it was quicker. But it wasn't the quality. They didn't like, you know, most people didn't want the sugar moonshine. They wanted the grain or the corn whiskey. But I didn't realize there was that much difference. I thought that it looks like maybe more trouble to make it out of the cornmeal than it would the sugar. But let me turn this over. Okay, go ahead.
A fellow named Marty Connors, who was a jailer of Jefferson County, and he had many friends out here because many persons from out here, he locked him, he had him in custody in jail. My father got off a put out one time with a person named Mrs. Wallace Mudd, and she and her husband or some of the relatives ran what we call the Colton Depot store, or Ballard store. Anyway, my dad got irritated with her and got calling her Sugar Liz, because supposedly she was selling illegal liquor through that store. And I remember him writing to Marty Connors and wanting to know if it had anybody in jail, but I gave her 3 or 4 different names that she might have used.
Oh my, he's going to check on that. Yeah.
Yeah, he was so put out with her. That's something.
Oh, that's, I've always asked about how many women were involved in all this, and other people hadn't mentioned too many. I guess it was some.
Well, see, not many, I mean, not too many women were proprietors of stores right. As they are today. But she was. She's the proprietor of that store at the depot. Mm-hmm. It was run by the Ballard family. She was a Ballard, Lizzie Ballard. Okay. But not too often. She married late in life. She married Wallace Mudd. I mentioned that they were a bit of 50 years old when she married, see. But women weren't running stores so much then like they would today. Mm-hmm. They just weren't in commerce.
I do know that in our public records, we do have lots of men and women cited for moonshining. There's no, illicit distilling is the term.
Yeah.
That and bootlegging, both ways. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few women in that. Some of them are wives of the men, and some of them are other people. And of course, it was a situation again. If you had a farm and you couldn't make it on your farm, this was a way of making money. And if it wasn't a way that the public frowned on, which it appears from everybody I talked to, that nobody really was very critical locally of it, particularly as long as they didn't get caught, they didn't look down on you.
Well, I think that was true because people just didn't have any other way to live.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them.
Do you ever hear of any fights or running gun battles or anything that the rum running, I mean, it was, you know, it's not like we had a mafia here or something, but maybe there was some kind of organized, I don't know whether there's any organization of this. You were talking about someone in Harrodstown was kind of the boss, but I don't know whether locally there was anybody that came forth as a leader.
I don't know.
Through that.
I just don't know.
I know
I guess Nancy told you about that thievery out there at their house.
Mm-hmm. I've had 3 versions of that, and they're all similar, but they all are, you know, from different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that has to be. I'm sure more of that happened in different spots. I imagine some of the moonshiners were robbed too, mm-hmm. as they were going from Barstown to Louisville. Somebody could lay in wait and hijack their cargo.
The Guthries were among those persons who had a good living before Prohibition and. It was a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had whipped them and ran it for a while and various, you know, trying various things to make a living.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, like you said, that he was running the distillery out there, working at it, and had a place to live out there at early times.
Mm-hmm.
And once you shut that down, then what do you do as far as income? It's not like if you had your money in the stocks and things, they were gone by 29. So you really did have a problem in trying to overcome
that. Well, T. William Samuels told me more than once that his father always believed that Prohibition would be repealed, and he tried to keep the distillery buildings up out of his income. Of course, he had some means where some of us did not have it, I think, and he tried to keep those distillery buildings up.
Because he had faith that it was going to be turned around.
That it would be turned around, and of course it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you know, when he came back to then to get going again, while he sold half interest in the corporation that was formed to some out people away from here, and eventually they had control, and he didn't. But he lost control of it, and I don't remember a whole lot about that. Then when they sold, they sold to one big one, Kess and Robbins, I believe, one of the big drug concerns. I know Bill didn't want that, but he didn't. His father did not have the controlling interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that so. You know, you didn't just open the distillery up after being shut down for 13 years. You had equipment that wouldn't work. You had new ways and new equipment that you,
yeah,
you might need, and you just didn't go out there and start making whiskey.
Well, so in most instances here, I think the records will show outside capital came in.
Where do you think that outside capital got their money?
Well, that's questionable.
That's another, I don't know whether they were contacts that had been used, but that, yeah, that's a interesting thing there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we saw the different people come in from Chicago and from other places. Most,
well, like that, the Mr. C.A. Newman, N-E-U-M-A-N-N.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first ones in the...
New York.
I thought it was from New York.
Uh-huh. Abelson was from Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Abelson came later.
Yeah.
But anyway, Mr. Newman was one of the first persons. They lived up there in the house. Pink house has been torn down, where that service station is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in operation now. And they rented there.
Mm-hmm.
And... he was one in the Barstown Distillery, and
well, the
you know, then they had a big thing over. Well, this was after repeal, stopping cattle around in his big stench.
Mm.
You know, down there around South Fifth Street, down in there, you know,
oh, yeah,
around
because
Martin
of tours
and
yeah,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, Presbyterian minister, Reverend J.D. Hunter, picked it up, and he had several of them in court, and I don't know where they were, some of them must have been eventually indicted, but at that time, then a restaurant had started, everyone named Benson tried to venture in, and it's a fellow named Mr. Lewis F. Seeger, who he and his wife were operating that, and they were interrogating some of these people in court. Asked Mr. Seeger, said, well, what do you think about this smell? Isn't it terrible? He said, it smells like prosperity to me. You heard that, haven't you?
That's good.
You
yeah,
know, in other
it's
words,
been a while.
It's just
yeah.
Everything been so...
so down.
Down.
Not, yeah.
So down, and for some, you know, for it to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, just said, it must have been a real hard period in those years.
Mm-hmm. Particularly when they knew how to make whiskey, or they knew how their particular craft. And for them to have to find something else to keep them alive until, like, if they had faith it was going to be rescinded, then they had to wait and just wait and wait every year kind of thing. And then all this time your whiskey's either sitting there in the warehouse being stolen or evaporating or whatever.
Well, it's running down.
Down.
And
your money not buying as much, and you can't borrow on it. I mean, if you went and borrowed on it, it'd burn up.
In the case of Mr. Les Samuels, I have a feeling he had a good bit of farmland down there.
Mm.
And they were able to, and he only had the one son, where some people had those very, very large families.
Mm-hmm.
And he only had the one, and he was able to hang in there.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah. Oh, man. Well, it, do you think that it had any effect on our morals today, or what we are still dealing with, and the fact that it was a national law that we chose to ignore? I'm talking in terms of the community and the county. Do you think that our attitude now against following the law or tax evasion or marijuana growing or whatever, do you think that has anything to do with it?
Well, only to this extent. I think the person who said that social life changed when whiskey came and,
mm-hmm.
and other types of alcohol came into the home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you know today, I don't guess there's ever any kind of a social gathering where a person's telling me don't think of alcohol.
Having a drink.
Uh-huh. The first thing, my mother died in 1960. My mother thought it was hard the fact that as soon as a person came to her, somebody asked if you'd like to have a drink. She didn't grow up that way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she said her grandfather, old Colonel Jim Boone, old Harrison, always had a keg in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And his home over there, this might be interesting, the politicians came through in horse and buggy, and Colonel Jim Boone's was the place they spent the night. And there was a big house they had, and of course they always had to have a full drink. But it wasn't, you know, a social thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it later has become. I think, well, the industry's, it just turned it around more
mm-hmm.
or less, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I think there's more drinking in the privacy of your home now that allows you to drink more, because you don't think, you know, first of all, you're not driving anywhere. You come in, and if you drink and are overindulged, then you don't feel like you're hurting anybody but yourself, and yet that's not good. I mean, that gives you an excuse, so to speak. Yeah.
For the most part, I'd say, of
mm-hmm.
course, I would say 90% of social gatherings.
Or some form of alcohol.
Have some form of alcohol.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's, you know, we almost like the tranquilizers of the mind. This is kind of the tranquilizer of the body sort of thing. And you just don't feel like you are celebrating or socializing unless you do. It's a state of mind. It's not real. I mean, it's not something you have to do, but you think so. Well,
I don't remember a whole lot.
Trying to think of another way that question that might not. We talked about Wallace Brown. Let me ask a question about. I had something this morning we were talking about. He was county judge during part of this period, Prohibition. Now, if I remember right, he was a Methodist.
Right.
So he would have been a teetotaler.
He was.
Oh, and I just wondered what his attitude would have been. Did he have to sentence any of these people, or did they all go to the federal court?
Well, many went to federal court, or they would have been in the circuit court. He was never the
circuit
judge.
Court. He was county judge.
County judge.
Okay.
Only misdemeanors would have come before him.
Judge Brown
came to our house fairly often, always there at Christmas time. He would just very politely turn down anything I called to ask him, and I imagine the man lived and died and never took a drink.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't, you had advertising in the Standard that the distilleries would pay for and things like that. He wasn't a person who wouldn't allow that, would he?
Well, I don't remember that we ever had any advertising from.
Maybe not then, I don't know.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think there was any. I don't remember at all. You see later, I don't think saloons ever advertised, and that's where that would be the retail outlet. I don't believe they did.
You couldn't go to a store and buy a bottle of whiskey then, basically, or you bought it through the saloon?
No, you just, I think it was all at saloons.
At saloons, okay. I guess it's one of those things I never thought of. I just assumed you had a retail store, but
I don't think so.
You're right, I don't think so
don't
either,
think
though. I can't think of any place that would have, saloon must have been by the drink.
Well, see, they didn't have the big, there were numbers of distilleries and none of them produced very much.
Mm-hmm.
This massive production came after Prohibition. I think one of my grandparents had this place called Gwin Springs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's out toward Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And they make about 25 barrels. Actually, they started out making it mostly for their own consumption.
Own use, right.
Now, there's where the difference is. I hadn't thought about that. You see, some are making it for their own consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And then I assumed then they would sell it to the saloon operators.
They could. Or they also could, if you took your own corn to them and brought your barrel, they could make it for you.
Well, now, you know, over at Maker's Market, they have what they call their courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And you took your bottle and they filled it for so much, didn't they?
Right.
See, it was a different type of operation than what we have today.
We have a journal that Franklin's great-grandfather, Dr. Rodman, kept. And he had an expense journal and then a little handwritten journal. And one of the expenses he had in there was whiskey for Josie. And Josie was his wife. And she liked a spoonful of sugar that was saturated with bourbon. And you could always tell when she was expecting a baby because he would buy this whiskey for Josie because to keep her stomach, you know, her morning sickness down. And she would eat the whiskey saturated sugar. And I know for a while I didn't understand why the whiskey for Josie, and then we found out through the family that was her, what she did for morning sickness. But you look at these ledgers and here you'd see all of a sudden there's about 2 months there that he'd be buying whiskey for Josie. He didn't get it by the barrel,
well,
you know, he was getting by the bottle.
She wanted a grandchild named Josephine Rodman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she picked up East last time I heard anything about her. And I guess still lived. She'd be at Archie's age, a little older. A few years older than I am. Biette and I are same age, born same year. Arch, what about Arch?
Mm-hmm.